Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical debate, dialogue, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions about all of the above. So, before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So I wanted to talk about some very interesting research that was published just yesterday in Science, this work by USC stem cell researcher Min Yu and other and also scientists at the Massachusetts General Hospital. They have been looking at circulating cancer cells. Regular listeners may remember that I have talked about this since I first heard about it about 3 or 4 years ago, at which point it was completely fringe, but now it's actually making its way into the major medical journals, so it's real. And it turns out that when you have cancer, yes, indeed, cancer cells are circulating in your bloodstream. Now, this is really big, folks. If you stop and think about the implications of this, it means that we may be able to find cancers and diagnose them much, much earlier than our current screening studies. Imagine if a blood test was done as part of your annual physical that scavenged and could pick out those 1 or 2 or 10 cancer cells that were circulating in that little vial of blood that was drawn from your arm, do genetic analysis on it, analyze what type of cancer is, come up with a probabilistic effect of where to look for it, and also suggestions about which chemical agents or pharmaceuticals, or maybe if they open their minds even wider, nutritional substances might be used to combat that particular cancer. What Min Yu and her researchers did was they looked at 6 patients who were known to have breast cancer, and they drew cells from their bloodstreams and were able to pick out the cancer cells because they knew what to look for and identified what genetic mutations were seen commonly in these estrogen receptor positive breast cancer patients. It's a complicated thing, and I won't go into the specific details because it's really more about the proof of concept here. They were able to identify a particular mutation in all 6 patients that would have led to a different selection of chemotherapy. In a related study, we have other cancer arrays that are already being used and reported in the medical literature. And the development of these genetic arrays, which use immunoglobulins that are tuned to identify certain cancers, we're able to look for genetic mutations. I shouldn't say immunoglobulins, it's mainly gene probes. And once identified, the fact that this particular cancer cell has this genetic mutation means that this chemotherapy drug is going to be effective, and this other one, possibly part of standard therapy for that particular type of cancer at the sort of gross level of, oh, this is a cancer growing in the lung, here's the drugs that we use for that group of the population that have cancers growing in the lung with the following surface characteristics. And now we can get below those surface characteristics and actually tune in on the unique genetics of every cancer, or at least some of the unique genetics of that cancer. It's a brave new world out there. It's very sophisticated and powerful technology, and I can't wait to see what it brings us down the road. But these gene probes are already starting to be used in clinical practice, and it's really just a matter of more information and refinement before I think this becomes a very standard part of not just treatment for cancer, but also surveillance for tumors. I had to comment just briefly on the sort of the story of the week, which is the child in Mississippi who we had thought might have been cured of HIV by early triple therapy turns out to have shown up with a few, only 16,000 copies of HIV in the bloodstream. But still, if that is in fact there and it wasn't just a cross-contamination issue, highly unlikely, then she wasn't cured as was thought. Now, that's really sad news, and it speaks again to how viruses are capable of insinuating themselves into our bodies and finding hiding places where, well, you just simply can't scour them out. In the case of HIV, the RNA virus converts itself into DNA, and then that DNA goes into our own cells of the lymph cells in the intestinal wall primarily and hides. So short of removing all of the intestines and all of the intestinal lymph tissue, which is, by the way, the majority of the lymph tissue in our body and would be lethal to remove, we can't scrub it clear of the AIDS virus. And so, alas, this child will need to go back on therapy. And the other child in California who we thought might have been cured is still on triple therapy. And a study that had recently been set up that was going to test this idea of whether we could cure HIV with really aggressive early triple therapy in children has, well, kind of gotten a major setback. It's not clear whether this study will go forward now, since the thing that made everyone so eager to try it has turned out not to replicate. Now, this is sad and a disappointment, but it's important to really look at the bigger picture on this, which is we keep trying. And when we think we've got something, we are in science, we're tentative about it. And we said, well, this looks good. You know, we'll have to wait and see. And that's really what it all amounts to, is when we think we've got something, it looks good, and then maybe or maybe not, 3 months later, 3 years later, 10 years later, there the other shoe drops, and it turns out there are circumstances where it doesn't look good, or situations in which something, after a period of time, turns bad, like the polyurethane mesh in the hernias, which is one that we'll be dealing with for many, many years to come. There's no way around this. And I don't know, I'll get on my soapbox for a moment and say, we can't move forward without making mistakes or without moving down false paths. It's an absolute necessity of the process. What we need to have is a society and a medical and legal structure that allows such mistakes to be identified early and acted upon in a positive way, in a way that says, all right, that didn't work. Let's try something else. Let's go back and compensate the victims of this improper approach. But this isn't the situation we've got. Anyway, I'll get off the soapbox for the moment. And we are going to go to our first caller, Joe in Brookdale. Hello, Joe, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I'm calling regarding your comments on the cancer markers in blood.
Go ahead.
I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and as a result of a lot of convoluted evaluations, I had a surgery scheduled, which then got canceled because I had a sodium fluoride PET scan, PET bone scan, and I lit up like a Christmas tree, and they assumed that I was a professional football player, which if you saw me, you would know that was a joke. But the net result was is that even though I lit up as though I had these various, that it had already metastasized to my bones, and I had lesions from the top of my skull to my toes.
Well, you probably didn't. You had something else going on that gave you a false positive, am I right?
It's unresolved as we speak.
Well, you have essentially what they're seeing on that scan, you understand, but I'm elaborating on this for the audience,
okay,
is you're seeing areas of increased metabolism where
Correct.
The
hot spots.
The cells are basically well, burning more energy than you would expect a normal bone cell to. And the inference, of course, is that it's a hypermetabolic area. It's cancer, but it could also be Paget's disease of the bone, for example, which would give you hypermetabolic areas. But it isn't. Paget's disease is not a cancer. They haven't been able to actually give you a diagnosis or a reason for this?
Correct. The options are that I've been presented, and that's why I took a different path, was to take out portions of my ribs where there's particularly hot spots and do pathology on that, ignore it completely as though it doesn't exist, and just go forward with conventional therapy.
They've checked your parathyroid hormone, right? I mean,
yes.
that's okay?
Yes.
Because that's another disease that would possibly potentially show you this.
Yeah.
Huh. I wonder how many people have they said anything to imply that there are other individuals who have been identified with these unexplained hotspots? Because I'm thinking this is a new technology.
It is. The sodium fluoride PET is very new.
Yeah, so it's a new technology. And the only people who are getting this test are people who have cancer, because
correct.
That's why we would do this test. So it makes sense that if there are other diseases that do this, we wouldn't know about them, you know, because
yeah.
we haven't had any opportunity to observe it before.
Yeah.
But it is, and naturally, of course, it would lead to false alms. So what did you decide to do? Yeah, where have you taken this?
Question, there is a track record of false positives, but they are not always false positives. And what has been difficult in the assessment is that the lesions do not present themselves as classic metastasis to the bone.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there are some questionable areas that they can't say that they're not. I mean, it was a 5-page report.
Well, it makes sense, and also you've got a can't see the tree for the forest,
right,
kind of issue.
And so the issue became, which leads to the genetic discussion, is mm-hmm. that I basically was faced with a choice of either do surgery or radiation, or a combination of the two, and suffer the resulting life-altering side effects of one or both of those without knowing that if, in fact, I have a type of prostate cancer that neither surgery nor radiation will be effective, if it's already metastasized to my bone.
What's your Gleason score?
A 7.
Okay. Go ahead.
If it's already metastasized to my bone, really all that's left is to go on hormone therapy, and if that were to fail, then to go into the experimental chemo, since chemo isn't used very frequently on prostate cancer. So that led me to kind of say, wait a minute, before we start slicing and dicing and taking ribs out and debilitating me further from the kind of standard of care, I want to take a closer genetic look, because I'd had the Genomics DX prostate cancer assay, which kind of said, well, this could be really bad, or it could not be. I'm in the high intermediate level of that, so it was not definitive one way or the other. So I started digging further, and I've gotten involved in next-generation genomic sequencing for cancer. And I've identified a new kind of industry that's emerging. It's a kind of concierge oncology, and there's a couple of places that I'm trying to work with, but I've run into a roadblock. One is Bespoke Oncology. I don't know if you're aware of them.
I'm not, but I love the name.
It's a fantastic name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially
Bespoke,
when you look up what
yes.
it means, since most people don't even have a clue when you tell them what that word is.
Yeah, well, I'm a clothes freak, so I know what it means.
Yeah, I know. I know you.
Yeah. Anyway, to the audience, it's what...
Dr. George Church at Harvard Medical School suggested that I check out is called Allocris in Germany. And these are, and I'm sure there's a couple of others, but not many. This is a new emerging area where the research world in genomics for cancer, the kind of the research docs have now started to go into the clinical field. And they are providing advice to oncologists by doing high-definition genomic sequencing of cancers, because as you mentioned, when you have when you have a cancer, you don't just have one. You have a family of cancers, and the particular indicated treatment or medication for what the label of your cancer is, be it breast cancer or prostate cancer or colon cancer, is not always, you've got other mutations going on that could be more severe and causing you greater harm than what the identified cancer is.
In addition, you've also possibly got mutations that would let you use a drug that's out of type. I saw,
correct.
I had a patient with breast cancer who had a mutation that allowed her to use a colon cancer drug,
right,
quite successfully.
I mean, Foundation Medicine has a test called Foundation One, which they look at about 286 genes, and they then tell you what mutations you have, and they put them into three categories. The first category is, here's what the accepted standard of care approach is. These are FDA-approved therapies. The middle category is, these are off-label uses. And the third category are, what are the trials that are ongoing for the type of mutations you have.
And so tell us, bringing it back to you, Joe, where do things stand at this point?
Well, where I'm at is with both Bespoke. It was kind of crazy because I thought I was going to be working with Bespoke, and I ran into a roadblock in which they do not give medical advice to the patient. They provide medical education to your attendings, and they need to work with a medical oncologist, but they need to work with a medical oncologist that is sufficiently trained and aware of the next generation genomic sequencing so they can have intelligent discussions.
Catch 22.
And what I've discovered, and so when I ran into that, and it's a legal roadblock. I mean, their work with me has resulted in them having to kind of redo all of their medical legal lease contracts because I don't have a medical
oncologist. Okay, Joe, you're giving us too much detail, okay?
Right.
And so let's try to keep it, you know, to the point.
Right.
So you're trying to
the same response from Allakris. They looked at my mm-hmm. medical records and pathology. They said they thought that they could do the kind of sequencing that was appropriate, but they need to work with a medical oncologist, the same exact rep.
Okay. So where are you?
One.
You can't find a doctor?
I cannot find a doctor that is sufficiently either interested, places sufficient value in, and most importantly, really knows the terrain. And what I'm told by both of these entities is that I need a medical oncologist that has a research background, that has worked in and is familiar with next generation sequencing for cancer.
Who takes your insurance?
Well, that yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's be honest here. This is an economically driven situation at its roots. This is a commercial company, and doctors essentially are also trapped in an economic model. And you've got a standard of care, and you've got a standard of care that not just dictates what you're supposed to do and what you can get sued for not doing or doing, which is where these companies are coming from. They want to
sure.
hide behind, they want somebody else to lose their license, not them.
Correct.
Okay, let's
no,
just,
I understand
you know,
that.
But the dynamic is that the other piece of the standard of care is that it tells you pretty much how much time you're allowed to spend on a patient based on how much you get paid for your time. And so, you know, asking someone to basically do, you know, the equivalent of a university level course in order to be up to speed to treat you is something.
Been there. That's what I'm told. I need to look for in their backgrounds. I just
well, the pro and the and such them. People exist, but they don't take your insurance. I mean, they'll be there. Such
well,
individuals
the
will exist.
So the problem has just been identifying something.
Such people will exist, but they'll be hard to find, and they'll be busy, and they'll already probably the ones that you're looking for will be associated with centers that are either completely commercial, you know, Cancer Treatment Centers of mm-hmm. America, you know, something like that, where it's cash basis, and you know, your insurance isn't
right.
going to cover, or a university setting where they are teachers and you're not going to get to them anyway. You're going to work through one or two levels of people who are learning at the feet of this fountain of wisdom. And so, you know, you're not going to find this individual who's, you know, the sort of, I don't know, Prince Charming doctor who has all of this knowledge and wants to work with this company and is still not going to charge you absolutely through the nose for their time. So I don't, it's an interesting dilemma because you're right there on the cutting edge of the art and science of medicine and the, let's call it the substructure, the economic substructure hasn't caught up with the science. And I think you raise an excellent point about how a person who's obviously well-educated and of a scientific mind like yourself can go out there and find the information, which, you know, up until the advent of the internet, there's no way you could even know any of this stuff because the information just, there would be no way for you to educate yourself. And you wouldn't even have access to the medical literature at the level it would have taken to have figured out what you figured out so far.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, our structure hasn't kept up with our knowledge, and you present a really beautiful example of it. I would suggest, and I will have a suggestion that is a little bit not what the company's told you, because I don't see how you can be successful going the way that they've told you. And that would be go to one of the major centers locally, you know, UC or
UC
or Stanford.
UCLA.
Please let me finish my sentence,
sure.
Okay? Because I'm sure you have, okay? But what I was going to say is go to one of the major centers. Find out who is in the departments of genetics, who's working with the Department of Oncology. In other words, don't go in through the medical treatment level. Go in through the academic research.
Oh, through the academic side.
Go through the academic research level and go through those lists of 20 people on the papers,
mm-hmm.
and find and search those and look for people who have a clinical practice.
So on the genetic side, working in oncology, but on the academic side of things.
Basically, you're trying to find out somebody who's got a clinical practice.
Okay.
Once you've identified an individual with a clinical practice, even if that person's clinical practice isn't a good fit, they will know who you can at least approach. And it's a sideways or a backdoor, kind of a side door approach, because you have to get past the secretary wall, and you can't go in the front door to a treatment center. Let me tell you just a little story about how hospitals work.
Sure.
Okay, I have a patient who himself very similar, very educated, knows his stuff, was able to get himself on a study on a compassionate use basis, FDA phase one drugs study for an investigational new drug. He was able to do it. Company wanted to work with him. But when we finally get down to the hospital level, getting the lawyers at the hospital to allow you to do something that might conceivably, under any circumstance,
yep.
create a liability for the institution,
yep.
is incredibly difficult.
I know of what you speak.
Yes. And so, and when you go with what you're doing, you have to go through the side door, because the front door is just going to bounce you back. And unfortunately, in this circumstance, I've spent 6 months, you know,
yeah.
scratching at the front door, and I think we finally found I think we finally got the door open, but I'm just kind of waiting for another door to slam down, because I've got learned helplessness on the topic. Anyway, thank you very much for your call, Joe. I think it's been really instructive.
And well, what I wanted to know is whether you specifically could play this role, and whether I should come and see you, and if not, if you could perhaps help find me someone who could, because I listen to you all the time, and it's real clear that you go very deep into the science of your profession, and so I thought maybe you could actually be this person.
Well, I could if I were an oncologist, but essentially what you're going to need is you're going to need somebody who can actually order the chemotherapy. And assuming that you're going to go forward to this point, you're welcome to contact me in a better context. This is not an appropriate context for a personal consultation. You know, I will talk to you further and try to understand what you need, which okay. is not clear, but certainly I can't order chemotherapy for you.
So should I do that through an appointment?
Sure, you
okay,
can do
great.
That. All right.
Wonderful.
Bye-bye.
Pleasure having you. Bye-bye.
Let's go to our next caller, line 3, Robert. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I have this kind of a mysterious itch on my forearms, and I do a lot of outdoor work, and, you know, I get involved with weeds and stuff like that. But this is, I'm almost tempted to think that it's somehow emotional. I see reddish little spotches, just, you know, nothing serious, and nothing really raised on the skin. And it comes and goes, and I think it comes when I'm getting a little tense or in thought, I'm thinking about what I'm going to do, what crew I'm going to hire, you know, strategies and so forth. And then if I start itching, if I start scratching, then it becomes pronounced, but I can resist scratching to a degree.
All right.
And then it seems a little bit inflamed, and I feel this redness. I mean, I feel general inflammation. But then it goes away.
Okay. All right. So I have some thoughts. First one is the itching on the back, the hairy side of your forearms?
Yeah, but it kind of moves to the underside a little bit.
Okay.
Mostly, you're right. It's on the upper hairy.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking that is that people who work outdoors over the years, they get a lot of ultraviolet radiation on their arms, and particularly the back of the forearms. That's what goes first on any of us. And the skin gets thinner. The collagen gets shredded sort of under the skin. And so, and the skin is thinner. The elastic fibers are damaged. So this skin is just more vulnerable, and it's more subject to itching through just physical mechanisms. There's two things that are important here, but the one I want to emphasize at the moment is one called histamine. We have a lot of histamine in cells in our skin, and when these cells release the histamine, or there's higher levels of histamine, which I'll come back to in a minute, it makes the skin itchy, and it triggers this cascade. If you then have itching and you scratch it, you physically create the release of more histamine. And so if you want to itch, scratch anywhere, and you will start, it will start to get itchy where you have just scratched. And that's a phenomenon, literally, like I said, related to a chemical spill of histamine under the skin at a microscopic level. So the reason I'm emphasizing histamine is you mentioned emotions, and adrenaline can actually trigger histamine release. So if you're upset or excited, histamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a part. It's connected with our alertness, and so there's an adaptive value to histamine. On the other hand, antihistamine agents, which I'm sure you're familiar with from just cold, allergies and allergy pills, things like Benadryl, often do release itching or reduce itching, and it's not just a sedative effect centrally. In many people, there is a high level of histamine in the skin for a variety of reasons. And so I want you to try taking children's doses of antihistamine, not a super high dose, but a combination of a children's antihistamine and ideally Tagamet or Zantac, which are available over the counter, and they're not at prescription strength doses, but at just regular doses. And ask the question, does this reduce my itching? So if you block the histamine at the skin level, so you're blocking both histamine 2 and histamine type 1 receptors when you take both types of pills, if that makes a difference on your itching or the threshold of itching, then you've, number one, answered the question, yes, this is histamine related. And number two, you've found something that you can play with to maybe reduce the reaction so that it's not bothersome for you. If, on the other hand, the histamine treatment that I'm suggesting doesn't do anything, then you may be just looking at a physically thinned tissue that is just more vulnerable because of those structural ultraviolet radiation changes that I had referred to. And in that circumstance, what I would ordinarily do is a lot of emollients. So using, let's say, vitamin E cream, some kind of really greasy kind of cream, and rubbing that in two or three times a day using, there's some vitamin C products that are not ascorbic acid, but are ascorbable palmitate. And that actually helps rebuild collagen a little bit. They're expensive, but that, if it's really bothering you, that might be a part of the solution. So I hope that's been helpful.
Yeah, just one thing, and prompted my call today, was I was awakened this morning, very early, and I was scratching pretty good. And so I was thinking, why would this itching, you know, why would the itching, occur while I'm asleep under, you know, and under the covers, no ultraviolet?
Classic. Heat. Heat will trigger the release of histamine, heat and sweating.
Okay.
So you got warm.
Okay.
You got warm.
All right.
Try the histamine thing. See if it makes a difference for you.
Thank you so much, John.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And we're going now to Molly, who's been waiting patiently. Hello, Molly, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi. How can I help?
I have a question about natural ways to build up iron. I tend to be iron deficient, and I've been taking the supplement called Floridex, if you know it. But I've been trying to read about other ways to do this. And one thing I read was, like, taking apple cider vinegar and molasses every day. So I wonder, would that have a negative effect on your teeth over time?
Well, I think the amount of time you'd have that the molasses or the vinegar in your mouth is pretty negligible. So I don't think it would, I mean, obviously molasses is sugar syrup.
So right, and I don't really want to take more sugar into my diet.
Right,
but.
Well, that's it's a source of iron, so that's where the molasses thing has come from. It's bioavailable iron. There's plenty of sources of bioavailable iron, even if you're a vegan. You know, you don't really have to worry that you're not going to get enough iron. You have to find a supplement that you can tolerate, but I really like ferrous fumarate, F-U-M-E-R-A-T-E. That's a form of iron that tends to cause less constipation.
Okay.
And I use that a lot in patients. Sometimes you'll have to get that made up, especially. It's not the easiest one to find on a shelf, but if you, with the web at your disposal, you'll be able to find it.
Okay.
It's like taking an iron supplement.
Okay.
It's just a mineral. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of sources of the mineral. In terms of food sources, the leafy green vegetables are excellent sources of iron, but they need to be broken up and have the absorption improved. And that's where the apple cider vinegar comes in, by the way, is that the acid in the vinegar changes the way that the iron is held in the molecule that you're consuming. And so it opens up that molecule and allows the iron to escape and be free, which helps your body absorb it more readily.
Oh, interesting.
So that's kind of the connection there. Do you have heavy periods?
I do.
So that's where your iron is going. Mm-hmm. And you might consider using something to help ameliorate the heavy periods. I had a email about that, actually. I was going to answer. And this was a person with heavy periods who was looking for natural ways to modulate this. So let me take a moment and put a shout out to Amy in Felton, who has well, obvious estrogen dominance. She's had ovarian cysts and heavy periods, and she's wondering what else she can do to help modulate those periods and help them be more regular but also less heavy. And so where I was going with her and you is something called Vitex or chasteberry. This is an herb that you can find at health food stores. You can find it as an extract, which is called a tincture, where they extract the active components from in alcohol. And a lot of people feel very good about that because it's just brandy or vodka, and you're using the ethyl alcohol group to extract the compounds, so it doesn't feel really synthetic and it doesn't feel pharmaceutical. It's, you know, an alcohol extract. It's like making a tea. Mm-hmm. So people feel comfortable with that process, and it might work for you from a psychological basis. And it does have the property of modulating the influence of estrogen, because basically if you can break down or back down, I should say, the influence of estrogen in a person who's got a little bit too much estrogen influence, then you mitigate the difficulties with heavy periods sometimes. So I often will use natural progesterone and cycle it, because that also helps reduce the amount of periods and regularize them. And you can get natural progesterone in a freeze-dried form. And you can use the Vitex and also some of the soy extracts. Soy has an estrogen modulating effect. So between those things, if you can get the heavy periods under better control, you're not losing as much iron, then you're mm-hmm. not chasing your iron supply all the time.
It sounds complicated. Is there like what could I look online somewhere to see sort of what dosage you would take and how you would do that?
You know, I'm sure you could, and there's a thousand things online, but I can't give you off the top of my head a website that's going to outline the program all that accurately.
Okay.
But I'm sure you could, with some digging, look up Vitex and look up natural progesterone and heavy periods. Those would be two search terms that I would start out with and kind of follow the links from there.
And then I had heard that like tea and milk sometimes prevent you from absorbing iron. Like, how long would you need to wait after taking the iron-rich food before you could have tea or milk?
You know, you don't want them in the stomach at the same time, so assume that your stomach dwell time is 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay.
So probably separate them by an hour at either end, and you should be fine.
Okay, that's good to know. Great. Thank you so much. That's
You're
very
welcome.
Helpful.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And other things that are helpful for estrogen dominance are using flaxseed, a couple of teaspoons, 2 to 3 teaspoons a day of ground, freshly ground flaxseed helps actually get rid of extra estrogen in people who are estrogen dominant. And by the way, you know who you are. You've got the estrogen dominant people are the ones who have heavy periods, lots of PMS, carry their weight in their butt and their thighs, tender breasts every month, often difficulty losing weight. Those are signs of estrogen dominance. And of course, ovarian cysts go along with that because of the estrogen driving the development. Other things that help there, besides the soy isoflavones, the Vitex, daily onions to get extra sulfur in, B vitamins to help with methylation, and also daily crucifers. So that's your broccoli sprouts, your kale, your Brussels sprouts. Those vegetables are really good because they provide compounds that help your body detoxify estrogen and drive estrogen into a pathway that, well, essentially renders it less harmless, less harmful. Estrogen is a very strong growth signal, and you don't necessarily want growth signals hanging around in your body telling things to grow, at least not all the time. I just had a quick correction here. I got two emails from different people about the fact that I misspoke, so I want to put out a retraction. We do apparently have no CMs in California. We had a email from someone who was wondering about mosquito bites, but I thought that was probably not mosquitoes at all, but some other kind of insect. And indeed, we do have small invisible insects that exist in the Santa Cruz Highlands and possibly other parts of California as well, I would be betting. And then you, but they aren't common, and so I was unaware that we actually had a Newseum issue in California. Anyway, the difference between a mosquito bite and this kind of bite is that the mosquito bite takes about 2 days for the full welt to manifest, and in the case of the Newseums, it's much quicker than that. And let's go now to Roberto. Hello, Roberto. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
My question is about high blood pressure. Several months ago, I was concerned about my blood pressure, and I started taking it. I noticed there were spikes occasionally, you know, like maybe once or twice a month. And so I went to my cardiologist, and they ran the full gamut of tests, and they did the ultrasound, the stress test, everything like that, and I passed those with full color. With good passing colors. And, you know, the doctor said it was a little bit high into, you know, talking about diet and exercise because I've been somewhat sedentary in the last year.
I'm glad your doctor talked to you about diet and exercise.
Yeah, he's a good doctor. He's very good.
Good.
But about within the month after that, I noticed that I'm pretty worried about my body, and I noticed I wasn't feeling good, and I started checking my blood pressure regularly. And it was regularly 150, 160 over like 97, which I know is high, hypertensive. So I want to go back to him and talk to him about medications because I am starting, you know, my diet has always been good. I don't eat salt. I eat lots of vegetables. I don't eat out a lot.
Did you go and get old?
I'm sorry?
Did you go and get older?
I did. I don't know how that happened.
Shame on you.
Is there a cure for that? Yes.
But it could be a causal factor here. Anyway, when you go back to your doctor,
yes,
take your blood pressure cuff with you.
Yes.
And have the doctor check your blood pressure on your cuff and on his cuff, and make sure that your cuff is accurate. That's
I
just
have a saponometer, and I use the blood cuff also, the automatic one. And I've checked them on myself, and I checked them to work, and I checked a bunch of people, and they were pretty close. So
you're saying you have two monitors?
I have a regular saponometer, and I have an actual blood cuff, you know, the automatic one.
Right.
And I've compared the two with myself and several people at work, and they were within 4 to 6 points on each scale.
Okay. So would be interesting for you to look at your timing also and see whether your blood pressure is higher in the morning than the evening. Have you done that by any chance?
I have. It's higher in the morning. I check it in the morning after I get up. I do a few things, and I sit down and do my blood pressure. And I've done it when I come home from work. I take a little nap, and I'll check it again. And it's lower, but it tends to be higher than it should be, higher than normal for my age.
Okay. Is it ever normal?
Sometimes it is.
Like I'm thinking bedtime and stuff?
No, it depends on the day, which surprises me, you know, and I can't relate an event or a stressful situation or anything like that.
Okay. All right. So you're going to go back to your doctor, and did you have specific questions about hypertension treatment?
I did.
Okay.
I was looking at online and looking at different medications and stuff and side effects and stuff like that. And one of my concerns is if I'm trying not to be sedentary, starting to work out. And, like, I used to run the steps and do it easily. And I'm worried about, like, exercising with high blood pressure. My mother had a stroke, and it runs in my mom's family.
Okay.
So I'm worried about stroking.
All right. Well, you already had a treadmill, and so you know that you can safely exercise from a heart standpoint, which is great because that's, like, out of the box. you know, someone's gone from being really sedentary and wants to take up a vigorous exercise program, you're a little worried that they're going to overstrain their heart, but you know that's not going to happen to you. So that's good. Exercise can increase blood pressure temporarily while you're doing it. Depends on the kind of exercise. Weightlifting is probably the worst one for that. Or straining. Sprinting is not as good as jogging in terms of causing a push in the blood pressure, because when you sprint, sometimes you get an adrenaline burst and that raises the blood pressure. But at the same time, when you exercise, your muscles are demanding more blood, and so you open up a lot more of your vascular space, which tends to reduce your central blood pressure. And that effect persists for several hours after exercise. So moderate exercise is the one that we really like for lowering blood pressure, not peak exercise.
Okay.
And the first thing you want to do is walk the steps and be, if you're, that's your choice, that you like to do the steps outside on the sea cliff or something, then you walk those steps multiple times, up and down for 20 minutes. And that's where you start. And then you start kicking up the speed.
Right.
But
okay,
you,
so I'm not putting myself at risk by doing the steps.
Not if you're moderate about it.
Okay.
Yeah. Not if you're moderate about it. And the other things that I wanted to say are, most of us are magnesium deficient, and in a lot of individuals, if you can get them on magnesium supplements, potassium supplements, I use a lot of L-arginine, relatively high doses of omega-3 fatty acids. These are all things that lower blood pressure, and if you are combining that with a diet that's rich in let's call them flavonoids, plant flavonoids. So we're talking 5, 6, 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And you've got to include beets and celery in those fruits and vegetables, because particularly the beets have natural blood pressure lowering properties.
Right. I've heard beet juice is really good for that, but I can't find it. So I've been eating a lot of beets.
Well, get beets. You know, beets are full of beet juice.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking, quick pick, beet juice. But I do eat a lot of beets. I love beets. So.
Good. So beets and celery. But celery seed in particular has blood pressure lowering properties. And you can also just use the greens on the celery that usually get cut off and put them in salad. Blow them through a juicer and just drink the juice that way. Those are all natural things that help lower blood pressure. But I do want to emphasize that the minerals often make a very big difference.
The what does?
The minerals, the potassium and the magnesium that I was referring to.
Yeah, I take a really good supplement.
No, honey. We're not talking about what you're going to find in a single mineral supplement. We're talking about doses of like 1,000 milligrams of magnesium, 5,000 milligrams of potassium. These are, let's call them nutraceutical doses.
Okay.
And you can find the recipes for this. There's also really excellent interviews with Dr. Mark Houston in my archives at AskDrDawn.com. Go into the archives, click on interviews, flip down for Mark Houston, and you'll be able to see it, okay?
Okay.
All righty.
So may I ask one last question?
Uh-huh.
So if I want to go back to my doctor, last time he said, well, you don't need any medication now. If I do everything that you've recommended, would you recommend a medication prophylactically to help get things under control while I get everything else back under control with diet and more exercise?
I'll often do that with folks. And part of it has to do with that, you know, people may have really good intentions out of the box. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, reality kicks back in and all of their changed behavior evaporates. And the only thing holding that blood pressure down at that point is the medicine. And so I tend to say we're going to start this as a backup measure. And then when you lose that 10 pounds and you've worked yourself up to the point that you're getting that 1,000 milligrams of magnesium and you're taking the fish oil and you're doing all these other things, then at that point we'll try taking the drug away and see if you can maintain your new normal blood pressure without the assistance of the pharmaceutical. So
okay.
it frames it as a reward, being able to go off the drug as a reward for good behavior, as opposed to a penalty for not doing the good behavior right.
Right. I like your that thought. So, like, I'm looking at the different medications. I like the ACE inhibitors, which seem to open up the peripheral arteries. But in your opinion, is there a drug that would be better as kind of like that prophylactic class of drugs?
We often start with the ACE inhibitors. I think for first-line therapy, either an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, which is an angiotensin receptor blocker, are the most rational and safe things for most people. Now, remember, you have to don't try this at home, children, kind of thing, because there are nuances in terms of what else may be wrong with the person that would mean that you wouldn't want to use one of these drugs. For example, a person with moderate kidney failure, these wouldn't be the go-to drugs in that situation. People who were taking potassium for some other reason could get into problems if they were taking these. And again, I said potassium for lowering blood pressure, but if I'm going to be putting someone on one of these agents on top of their potassium, I have to look at their dosing and monitor their blood levels, because we can get into trouble with too much potassium.
Mm-hmm. I eat a lot of bananas, 2-3 a day.
Well, that's not a good idea. Why are you eating all that starchy fruit?
I love bananas. It's my snack.
Okay, how's your weight?
I'm over about 20 pounds.
Well, I'll tell you, there's some, pardon the pun, low-lying fruit there on the weight loss is get rid of the bananas.
Okay. All right.
Or make them stretch, you know, smaller amounts. Throw them in with some pineapple and some berries and, you know, reduce the volume on the bananas there. I know they're easy.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Bye-bye, bananas.
All righty.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, because, I mean, weight loss probably is for blood pressure control. It's amazing what sometimes just taking off 5 or 10 pounds, there's no longer a blood pressure issue. There's a magic threshold for some people, and when they get above it, boom. Another thing that can creep up on you is alcohol. And there is definitely a threshold effect with alcohol. Some patients can do fine with, you know, 2 beers a day, but if they slide into 3 beers a day, suddenly their blood pressures are going up and it's time to go to no beers a day and behave yourself for a while and see if the blood pressure comes back down. So over the years, those are a couple of tricks I've learned. Sometimes all you need to do is take something out of the diet and before you start putting things in. We're going now to Elizabeth in SoCal. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hi.
On Tuesday, I was diagnosed with MRSA on a sore on had on my ear.
Okay.
And I've been on clindamycin since, and I wanted to know how long before I'm no longer contagious, because the sore is no longer contagious.
Well, as long as you have an open wound, I would be a little concerned about being contagious. And unfortunately, with MRSA in the ear, you need to get your nose swabbed and see whether or not you're growing MRSA in your nose, because you may actually be colonized. So it's a distinct possibility, because I'll fess up, you know, I scratch my nose and my ear, you know, probably once an hour. So the chances of a transfer in either direction are pretty good. And when you take a systemic antibiotic, that's great. It circulates in your bloodstream, but it isn't necessarily going to come out in your nasal mucus at a high enough concentration to get rid of a colonization with MRSA. And fortunately, if it's happy growing in your nose, it can get into a cut, paper cut, sore, blister.
Right.
And it also raises the risk of being transmitted to others. And you live in a household by yourself, or do you have other people in the household?
By myself. However, I take care of my grandkids.
Well, you know, it's not a bad bet that they gave it to you. So, but that being said, frequent hand washing, getting your nose swabbed, make sure you're not a carrier. If you are a carrier, then we use antibiotic creams in the nostrils to knock that down. and we can generally get rid of a carrier status, but it does require a certain amount of diligence, and the oral antibiotics won't do it, not by themselves.
Wonderful.
Yeah, try not to get too freaked out about this. I mean, exercise, good hygiene. If the children develop a sore or an abscess, then it should be checked for MRSA. But the MRSA that grows in hospitals, the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus in a hospital setting, is a really different animal than the one that's out there in the community. So it isn't, when you read about MRSA and it sounds like the plague, you know, the flesh-eating plague, remember, it's sort of like the conversation we had about cancers earlier this show. There's variations in the thing that you call cancer, and there's variations in the thing that we call MRSA. It's not a monolith. And so you can have a less aggressive, less dangerous form. Doesn't mean you don't take it seriously, but please don't stay up at night, you know, with a toxic thing in your head about this.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
All righty. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to wrap up with just a couple of emails because it's a little bit late to be taking another call. So last email here from Glenn, pill stuck in throat. I heard a caller ask about a pill stuck in his throat. Recently, I had a multivitamin stuck in my throat. Gulps of water and gargling didn't dislodge it. Before heading to urgent care, I tried the internet, and there was the answer. Lean your head all the way forward until your chin touches your chest, and then swallow. I think the explanation had to do with the angle of the esophagus. Well, I'm very interested in putting that out there and asking my listeners to put that in the back of your head and give it a try. Let me know if it works, and I assure you I'll be doing field testing on this idea myself the next time that I get something stuck in my throat. I'm going to give it a try. Tuck my chin and swallow, see if that helps. And I hope you've enjoyed this hour as much as I have. I'll be back next week to take more of your calls and emails. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.